You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Investigative journalist Nikki Hager is unveiling further wrongdoing by the New Zealand Defence Force. In a 12-page article published 2 days ago in North and South magazine, Hager reveals allegations of cover-up of potential war crime, a damaging drinking culture, and the refusal of taking action on sexual assault complaints brought forward by members of the military. First, I asked him to explain the war crime cover-up allegations.
So I wanted to touch, obviously, on your latest investigation, which does cover quite a bit of ground, I guess, different allegations. I wanted to start with the first one, which is about the cover-up of war crime, which is a very serious allegation. Can you walk me through what you found out?
Yeah, so the way this all came about was that there were people inside defence who read about the Hit and Run one, my last year book, co-authored book, about war crimes in Afghanistan, and saw the Chief of Defence Force saying it wasn't true and nothing had happened. And there were people thinking, hang on, not only do I think that's true, but there are other things that I know about, which I wasn't happy about at the time. And so I've had a succession of people coming to see me, and one of them raised a story about another war crime in Afghanistan. And it takes a bit of explaining because it's slightly complicated. And it's about the laws governing medical people in a war, because they're going way back in the Geneva Conventions. There are these very strict laws which protect the people who kind of go out on the battlefield and pick up the bodies or who drive the ambulances and things. And the idea is that they have a special protection in a war, but the deal is that they have this kind of immunity to do their work and to look after the wounded, but they can't just join in the fighting suddenly if it suits them. And the case which I was told about was one where that had happened. There was an SAS, New Zealand Special Air Service medic,
mm-hmm.
who'd been asked by his bosses to go out and help on a US Special Forces raid in southern Afghanistan. And which was, you know, a legitimate thing. They needed extra medics, and so they asked the New Zealanders to help. And then when they were in this assault, when the American forces were in this assault on an Afghan compound in a village, they started being shot at by people inside the village who, well, I don't know the answer of whether they were aggressive people or whether they were just local people who wondered who was attacking them in the night. But as they attacked, the medic started helping to fire back, which he wasn't supposed to do at all. And when he moved forward, he found that the people he'd been shooting at were actually children who had had guns, who joined the adults in fighting, but they were children. So he had broken kind of number one rule of being a medic and having the protection of international law on the battlefield. And then a great big hoo-ha began, because various things were going on. One thing was he was feeling terrible about killing children himself. The Americans were saying, oh no, it's great you helped us, you know, fighting these terrorists, so we want to give you a medal. But when he got back to base, the SAS bosses were saying, hang on, you're not supposed to do that. And they threatened to court-martial him. And so there was this very unhappy, stewed-up medic who in the end was so... within a few months, was so angry and disillusioned about what had happened, about him being put in a position where he ended up killing children and then being threatened with court-martial, although he had done it wrong, that he cleared out and left the military, which was a kind of a tragedy and breaking international law and things all at once, but he hadn't gone out to try and do that. And then the weirdest part of the story happened at all, which is what stirred up the person who wanted to talk to me, which was that the proper thing was to admit that they'd broken the Geneva Conventions and to do a proper investigation and to go through all the processes.
Mm-hmm.
And instead what the SAS did was they thought, well, the Americans said he needed a medal. Maybe we'll just do it that way. And so on the day where Willie Apiata famously got the Victoria Cross, and there was all the big hoo-ha about bravery and honour and the rest of it from the New Zealand military, they slipped this other guy in without using his name and gave him the middle one down from a Victoria Cross, saying that he had bravely and wonderfully fought, and it was a wonderful sign of the integrity and the great actions of our special air services. And actually, he shouldn't have been getting a medal at all. There should have been disciplinary action, and there should have been a great big inquiry into what had gone on. So it was what the person who came to see me was saying was, it was a really terrible example of the New Zealand military covering up yet again and not being prepared to face up to things that go wrong.
I'm really surprised that such a situation occurred in the first place, and that this medic didn't seem to even know the rules that apply in such a situation.
Yeah, that good point. Now, I didn't manage to drill down into that, but the other thing that I was being told over and over by not just this source but other ones is that there's a mood in the SAS that, of course, rules matter and of course people got to do things, but they're different. That they don't feel as accountable, or that anyone would find out, partly, and so they work by a different rule book to the rest of the New Zealand Defence Force,
which they're not supposed to, because the rules do apply to them.
The rules apply to them, and in fact apply more to them in a way morally, because they're more often in the difficult or dodgy or risky situations.
So why do you think, really, they gave him the medal? Do you think it was just because it would have been, I don't know, it wouldn't have been a good look to have to send a soldier, a medic, to court-martial? Or was it just sort of easier to do it this way?
Do you know what? My head kind of spins at the thinking that went into it, because all they had to do was, if they wanted to cover it up and not... And if they were just thinking, we don't want to look bad, so we'll do nothing, they could have just done nothing.
Yeah.
But so this is only a guess now. But what was going on at that stage was that the SAS was in the middle of a great big campaign of self-promotion. They organised a TV program about themselves with Willie Apiata before Willie Apiata had even been told that he was getting the VC. They had arranged a documentary crew to be working on it, and they commissioned people to write a book about it. In other words, and what they were trying to do was they were trying to raise the profile of the SAS so that people would regard, more or less, to paint themselves as the military equivalent of the All Blacks, these kind of giant, fantastic, you know, hulks of manhood, who people would respect and revere and things, without, of course, ever being told what they do. And so all this other promotion was going on, and I think they just got into their heads that it would be good to have more medals going out on the day. That's all I can imagine. It doesn't actually make very much sense when the basis for the medal was so unsound.
Yeah, but I suppose a medal looks better than a medic in court-martial.
Oh, when you hand out medals, it makes the military look better. And it makes the SAS look better. So I guess maybe they were looking around for reasons to hand out medals, yes.
Just to keep talking about the SAS, another thing that you bring forward in your investigation is that there is some sort of a culture of drinking that goes against the rules again, and that the NZSAS was a part of. Can you develop that a little bit?
Yeah, look, this might sound like a picky issue, but I'll explain the particular story and then why I think it's important. So another thing that the ex-SAS person told me, which was along the lines of not feeling like they had to obey the same rules as everyone else, is that they were working in a base in southern Afghanistan with American troops and Canadian troops and all these different nations' special forces. It was a big special forces base for fighting the war from. And all the other people there obeyed the law of that country, which was that it was a Muslim country and they wouldn't have alcohol. So the Americans didn't have bars and parties and things like that. There was no alcohol around, except for the New Zealanders. And their particular trick was that they would have pallets of rations come in. This is like a big thing that you lift up with a forklift and put into the back of the plane. And all around the outside of the pallet would be the ration packs, the pre-prepared ration packs made by a firm at Linton outside Palmerston North. But inside this sort of skin of ration packs was just masses of alcohol they were bringing in. And that meant the New Zealanders were drinking their heads off, and they were also inviting in the Americans and the other people for great big piss-ups. Which might sound like, well, is that such a big deal?
Mm.
But at the same time, this is the bigger picture. What I was being told about was there's a lot of untreated stress and mental health problems that go with high, pumped-up combat roles. And what maybe the almost like the more important part for New Zealand of this, or the equally important part of the revelations, were not just about what happens in Afghanistan, but what happens in New Zealand. And what I was being told about was essentially that you can't have organized, trained aggression plus a very heavy drinking culture and not have victims, not have casualties. And the casualties there aren't Afghan children, they are partners and wives and domestic violence and screwed up guys whose lives are not properly in control from too much drink and drugs. So there's a, even, you know, you wouldn't know this on the outside, especially when you get the kind of heroic and medals and Anzac days, but there's a really big problem of severe drinking and the consequences of severe drinking.
Yeah, and the New Zealand Defence Force has responded to this by saying that it was just small amounts of NZSAS branded wine and spirits brought for and paid privately by the Babakura military camp members, and that it was just for consumption and gifts to coalition members, which doesn't actually make it right.
Exactly. There's various things you can do when you're a PR person faced with the fact that people have broken the rules. You can deny it, but it was a bit hard to deny that. So then you minimise. And so what that statement was, it was a minimising thing. It was only small amounts. It didn't do any harm, which is not answering the question about whether or not there were strict rules and all the other countries were obeying them, and then the SAS felt it was above those rules.
The other point that I want to touch on is what you unveil as well, is that the refusal to deal with sexual cases of sexual assault that are brought to the attention of the New Zealand Defence Force, and their refusal to handle it according to the procedures and doing it the right way?
Yeah. So, again, this was people who came to see me. This is different people now who were saying, yeah, hit and run, cover up, but this happens all the time. It's a mentality in the Defence Force that if you're an officer and you don't admit to something going wrong, it won't hurt your job. You won't get in trouble for it. So that that military secrecy mixes with this culture of not wanting to front up on things. And so this is a really awful side of it. These were stories about women in the military who had sexual abuse, and they could hear the Chief of Defence Force saying, "We've got Operation Respect. We have zero tolerance for sexual, inappropriateness in our forces." Mm. But when they actually had things go wrong for them and complained about it, nothing would be done, or they would be fought by the authorities. I'll give you an example of a story. There was a woman at Ohakia, the Air Force base outside Palmerston North, and she was in one of the logistics units there, a civilian woman, meaning not wearing a uniform. And she went to a Friday night party, and wherever you are in the military, think really kind of out of control heavy drinking, as we've been talking about, which is endlessly tolerated for some reason. And while she was there, two of the guys in her unit decided that they'd been thinking about her and wanted to go after her. And so one came up in front of her. They kind of grabbed her from the back and the front at the same time. One grabbed her by her breasts at the front, the other ground his groin into her back, and they pinned her between them, thinking it was a real hoot to get the woman in the group, which she was understandably really upset about and insulted about, given that she was, working there with them and supposed to be an equal in the employment on the base. And so she went to her boss, who just joked it off and said no, he wasn't going to do anything. And she went to her boss's boss then, And what she realised was that the two guys she was complaining about were what they call at-risk trades. These were they had particular skills which were hard to replace, and so the bosses were thinking, nah, we don't want to risk these guys because we need them for the work on the basis, and sexual violence comes second. And so she did the proper thing. She did what they were women of the Defence Force had been told they should do, and there'd be zero tolerance and so on. So she worked her way up. She went through the different layers, many layers of the hierarchy through the, and eventually got to the Deputy Chief of the Air Force, and still no one would do anything. And she got to the Chief of the Air Force, Mike Yardley, and he refused to do it as well. So finally, with the backing of the defence lawyers, because there were defence lawyers who were upset about this and thought there should be charges, they went right to the Chief of Defence Force, Tim Keating, the same guy who was denying the hit-and-run allegations, and said, and he was asked to take action on it because no one was prepared to do it, and he refused as well. So you had had every single level of the Defence Force, which had been kind of promoting itself as really good on these issues, not one of them were prepared to make a stand. And what the person said was that if all through an organisation people can see that grabbing breasts and things is okay and nothing happens to you, they're saying the message from the top is loud and clear that anyone can do it, that this isn't a problem. So they've got so defence has really got a problem. They've got a problem which is a particular problem on things, on problems in Afghanistan or problems with domestic and sexual violence. But they've got a general problem which is people not being prepared, having a culture where people are basically too scared in the hierarchy that if they point things out or take a stand, that it will hurt their careers. So there's a big problem there.
Yeah, there's there's a woman who was sexually harassed while in the New Zealand Navy, and who has taken it to court, and she reacted to your latest revelation saying that I guess she's happy that she realises that it proves that her case isn't isolated, first of all. And then she also suggests that the military should implement an anonymous quarterly survey so that personnel can report incidences of abuse. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's great. Hayley's part of the story, Hayley Young. She had an appalling time, and what she did was, the typical thing is that she just kind of took it on herself and realised she'd lose her job if she reported first a rape and then a whole lot of sexual harassment. And she'd been told, you'll lose your job, all your career and all your hopes won't work if you do something about this. And eventually it wore her down, and she finally wrote to the Navy and said, I'm leaving, and this is why I'm leaving. And rather than help her, they just caused her endless troubles. And there's this terrible footnote to the story, which is that after she'd left, she hadn't complained, she hadn't sued them or anything, she hadn't tried to get compensation. Then she, one day someone contacted her and said that, did she know that the military was using her face on a whole huge promotion of posters and stickers and Facebook and things, kind of ads and things, to promote the Navy to young women as a career?
That's pretty ironic.
And something broke inside her, and she has been, she found a lawyer, and she has been suing them since then. Now, the point of the story is, I mean, and what an appalling story, and luckily she's holding together, and she'll survive. She's a good person. But the crazy thing in the story is that defence have fought her with their lawyers and their hugely disproportionate resources every step of the way. And again, this is what the message of this is to women inside the Defence Force is, that if something happens to them and they speak up, they're only going to have trouble. Which is like just such an appalling story, picture to be putting out there.
It sounds like NZDF is more interested in covering up in the PR aspect of it, and just keeping that good image to get more recruits and looking appealing to the public, rather than really dealing with whatever's wrong, the multiple things that could be wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I would summarise this by saying that, that in the SAS there's a culture of impunity, that nothing will happen to you. And in the whole greater Defence Force, there's a sense of no one will ever find out, and we don't have to act on things if we don't want to. And underpinning this is secrecy. Like, I know I'm working on at the moment on the inquiry into the hit and run, dead children and dead and injured children and things, incidents. And all the way through, we're not being countered by facts or something. We're just being countered by secrecy. And it's my belief that secretive organisations inevitably act differently than open ones. So the people think that they can spin a line or not tell the truth or just push something under the carpet and no one will ever find out, then that's an irresistible temptation to not have to front up and to not have to admit something went wrong. In other words, military secrecy, which has got, you know, you can understand why there's a bit of military secrecy in the world. You don't say, we are going to go down this dusty road the day after tomorrow and do something about it because someone might be waiting for you. So there's a place in the world for a little bit of military secrecy, but you end up getting a lot of military secrecy which is being used to make life easier and to hide problems and to avoid reputation problems and the rest of it. And that's the kind of knot that the military is stuck in at the moment.
So I suppose that's what pushes you to do what you do, is making sure that we reach a point where we can have the transparency.
Yeah, well, and actually it's motivating, but it's also frustrating that you shouldn't have to have secret leaks and people are risking their careers and possibly going to prison. You shouldn't need to do that to have normal accountability for a government organisation where everyone's paid by the public and every piece of information belongs to the public. It shouldn't be that hard, but it is. They get away with murder because they've got the right to keep things secret under so-called operational security.
Do you think in New Zealand people tend to the general public tends to be quite forgiving and sort of brush it under the rug because we have this image of the military as being, I don't know, strong men that are doing the right thing?
No, I don't think so fundamentally. I think that I've got a great trust in ordinary people that if people find out what's going on and they get real information, you know, the kind of things revealed in this article I did this week, people won't approve of that. If they read it, they definitely won't approve of it. But what we mainly get from the Defence Force is there are 50 or 60 PR people there. I mean, they've got a squadron of PR people, and so nearly everything that people hear has been designed and carefully scripted, and the photos have been taken, and the video's been arranged, and the social media's been coordinated, so that people get a picture which makes the military look good, which is fine if they've done something good, if they're saving people after the cyclone in the South Pacific, let them do their positive PR. But when the mentality becomes, we don't have to front up on things, we don't have to tell the truth, and we've got this great big machine that will pump out this kind of wash of kind of manufactured good news stories, that's not democracy. That's not how a government agency is supposed to present itself to the world and face up to things. It's kind of public relations have taken over the process.
Is it hard for you to fight that big squadron of PR people? I guess since Hit and Run, it's probably become slightly easier of people knowing who you are and what you've done and being more willing to talk to you. But is that quite hard?
Yeah, it's an unequal battle. Like, I use the Official Information Act, and I write the letters, and they try to fob me off, and they make excuses, and they it should be much easier. At most government agencies are much, much more open than the military, and the military has this constant get-out-of-jail-free card of saying, oh, no, we couldn't possibly tell you that because there are security implications. But actually, despite all their PR people, it's kind of, if a persistent person doesn't let go, luckily the information still comes out. And they actually set themselves up for it, because organizations which are transparent and which tell the truth don't have trouble sitting around everywhere to be found out and to come and bite them on the bums. But the Defence Force has it everywhere, because everything they do practically and anything that goes wrong is hidden. So they've kind of, they make their own problems. You know, we all know that government agencies are made of people, things go wrong. In a war, of course, things go wrong, you know. And no one holds that against the individuals concerned. That's no different from the police or the Ministry of Education or whatever. But if your attitude is to hide, 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 spin, you're asking for trouble, because there's constantly going to be things coming out showing that you didn't tell the truth.
I'm just going slightly off topic, but the government announced last month, I think, that they were extending the deployment in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And so there's going to be more people and being sent, more troops, I guess, sent there and more people staying there. I don't know how to phrase that, but... have you talked to anyone, any of your sources talk about that, about this constant prolongation of the war that doesn't really seem to make any sense in any improvement of the situation?
I haven't talked to anyone recently about it, but I wrote a great big fat book called Other People's Wars about the war in Afghanistan and all the different aspects of it. And what you're talking about is that a war like that, which is like now a few times, you know, much, much longer than the First World War or the Second World War put together. So this long, ongoing, incoherent war, it gets a momentum of its own, and the momentum is awful, because it's not about where, it's not ultimately about can we help to protect people or we're fighting the baddies. It's about our allies are noticing that we're still there, and if we leave, we might look bad to our allies. And it becomes, and what it resolves into is essentially a foreign policy stunt, that we're showing our commitment to the American forces, basically, by sticking around in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if we finish, which would be the logical thing to do after 18 years.
Yeah.
That maybe we won't look as committed. And so it's not actually about what's happening on the ground or whether, you know, a micro contribution from a tiny state in the South Pacific makes any difference to the war, because it doesn't at all. It's all about diplomacy. And you shouldn't be in wars in sad other people's countries for diplomatic reasons.
Yeah, and I suppose this feeling of being a soldier, being deployed in the Middle East, and this idea that, well, the realization that you're there for diplomatic reasons rather than for actual military reasons, that must also take a toll on you, and that wouldn't help with the mental state and just understanding what you're doing there.
I'll give you a good example of that. New Zealand's largest and longest single deployment in Afghanistan was a provincial reconstruction team. This was a counterinsurgency unit that sort of controlled a particular province called Bamiyan of Afghanistan for 11 years. And when we arrived there, we took over an American base at a time when the Americans were trying to free up more of their troops for fighting in Iraq after the Iraq invasion. So we took over it. And it was probably the most peaceful part of Afghanistan. That, you know, the dog slept in the streets. A bullet was never heard going off in anywhere. And we just ran that part of the country for them with the intelligence people and the patrolling people and the psychological operations people. Mm. It was a standard part of the operation in Afghanistan. And then it gradually got more and more dangerous. The war came to Bamiyan. There were more and more roadside bombs. There was more pressure from insurgents. The first New Zealander died, and so on. So things got more and more hairy. And by the end of it, they were more or less just restricting themselves to base it had got dangerous, and then finally they cleared up because they were scared more New Zealanders would die.
Hmm.
Now, the point of the story is that the professional soldiers were totally appalled by this, because what you're supposed to do is to go into a dangerous situation and protect the locals when there's a danger there and leave when things are safe again. And what actually happened was that New Zealanders hung around there making a fantastic, you know, diplomatic gesture of, haha, look, we're part of the war and we're being very useful allies. And then when things got dangerous, and it was actually dangerous for the locals and the war was going wrong, they hid in the bases until they had organized to leave and they cleared out. And this had a very destructive effect on quite a lot of soldiers who could see that something was really unsound about what was going on there. They, you know, it got dangerous and they left.
What decided you to look into that, and what keeps you going to this day?
That's a slightly long story. So the thing that started me off on this was, so I've been researching Afghanistan since early in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early war, this was after the September 11 attacks, and the countries had pressure on them to be involved in it. All countries had pressure to, you know, be for the Americans or against them, as George Bush said at the time.
Mm.
New Zealand sent the SAS into Afghanistan without even telling the public they'd gone. They were there for many months before it was even confirmed that they were there. And basically, I was offended that we had gone off to war. This is me, personally, as a person. I was offended that we'd gone to war and we weren't even being told that they were there, that our military was there, or what it was doing, or what we were involved in, whose side we were fighting on and things. So I started getting my first sources back then and made a mission of finding out about the, particularly at that stage, the special forces, the SAS, and the intelligence staff who were being sent into Afghanistan. And I just kept going on it because there was this kind of craziness that we go on endlessly about Gallipoli and the honour, and we talk about Anzac Days and things, but we don't even know what's happening in the war that's going on right at that moment, like nothing practically apart from military PR. So I eventually wrote this great big book, which I recommend to anybody who's interested in war and peace, called Other People's Wars, which explained all the different aspects of how we got there and what we got stuck in and the incoherence of it. And then I kept writing about those things, and then I did the second book with John Stevenson about, called Hit and Run. And so really it was a sense of indignation that the military could think it could fight its longest war, overseas war in our history, and that all that the public would hear about was what the PR department thought sounded nice and friendly and would make people agree with what they were doing. So it was this indignation of people thinking they had the right to leave the public out of something so important.
Do you get threats sometimes? Do you get people trying to really prevent you from doing your job?
I get called a lot of names by people who want people not to take me seriously or read my work. But no, we live in a very safe country here.
Yeah.
You know, that's, so no, you can sort of you can think to yourself that maybe someone will come and try and scare you. But actually, no, we're not. Compared to all the other countries where people do this work, and they really are a threat, and they take terrible threats sometimes, and for their families, we're the lucky ones. We mustn't be scared, and we have to, you know, do the job.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.